The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Patricia Ann Neely is a professional musician. She plays viola da gamba and other bowed string instruments, and she's made numerous recordings and performed all over the world with top early music ensembles, including the Folger Consort, Smithsonian Chamber Players, Glimmerglass Opera, New York City Opera, Boston Camerata, Boston Early Music Festival Orchestra, the Waverly Consort, and many, many others. A founding member of the viol consort Parthenia, Pat Neely is also managing director of Abend Music, New York's period instrument string ensemble. Pat Neely is a board member of Early Music America and the Viola da Gamba Society of America and chair of both organizations' Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Committees. We had our first conversation back in 2019, and Patricia Ann Neely agreed to touch base again via Zoom for some follow-up. Hi, Pat. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Thanks for having me back.
So we last spoke pre-COVID. We were so young and innocent then, right? We could be in the studio together then. It's been a heck of a year and a half. How have you been through this strange and challenging time?
Well, you know, when we first talked about diversity, it was before all of this happened, not only the pandemic, but the resulting protests and negative activity in the country, which followed for the past year. And so how am I doing? Like everyone else, all of this has been unexpected and a real challenge. Mm-hmm. I started off in a position of being unemployed as of June 2019. So I was spending all of my time looking for work. When the pandemic hit, it was a sort of slap in the face. I was just about to have a second interview for a job that I really wanted at a museum, and all the museums were shut down, and life just stopped. And I have to say that now that we're getting out of it, I mean, I talked to another friend of mine about this. We're thinking about the future, but every time we talk about something positive, we say, but what if? And I think we are all going through a post-traumatic stress is the after what we would call side effect of being vaccinated. Mm-hmm. There's that moment of glee. And then you think, okay, now we're getting out of this. Where am I going to be in a few months? Mm-hmm. And that's the scary part. The silver lining about my situation of being unemployed is that I am collecting unemployment. And that runs out in September. Mm-hmm. Performances have been few and far between, but Abend Music has started to perform this season, and we've done it virtually, and hopefully we can look forward to an in-person season. Mm-hmm. Last year, unexpectedly, we lost our violinist to cancer, and that was not expected. Mm-hmm. So there have been ups and downs. I always have to think about the fact that what I'm going through, someone else could be going through worse. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the political climate right now, I am going to try to focus on moving forward since we have had a shift in leadership.
Yeah. So I saw a contribution you made to a PBS project, completing the sentence, "I took a risk when," and I just found this really, it just really moved me. Would you please talk a little bit about that? Talk about that risk you took and what were some of the things that made it risky for you?
Well, this was the American Portraits, I think. And I started reading some of the submissions mm-hmm. by others. And then I started looking at some of the, they give you the first sentence and you elaborate on that. And when I got to I Took a Risk, I suddenly thought, that's me. Everything I've done has been a risk. It's been abnormal. And I was trying to recapture the spirit I had as a young person embarking on a career, not knowing whether it was going to be fruitful, and trying to resurrect that energy to support me during this this past year. And so I said, let me think about this. And I started writing it. I said, if I write something and submit it, I might begin to start really thinking about a way to move forward. And I started with the interest I had in early music and knowing that music, even at that time, was not guaranteed. But I also had an interest in science in high school. And I remember one of my science teachers, when we were dissecting something, said, oh, you're going to make a really good surgeon. You have the hands for it. Hmm. And that's a powerful, it doesn't sound like it is, but it's a powerful analysis for someone who's 18 years old to hear. And I began to really think about becoming, working in science or becoming a doctor. Mm-hmm. And I had all intentions of doing that when I got to college. And I even declared pre-med as my major. And those were the most horrible 2 days of my life because I left the office and I was not convinced. Mm-hmm. And I realized I really want to be a musician. So I went back 48 hours later and changed it to music.
Wow.
And that was my first risk. My father said, what makes you think you can be a musician? And I said, well, our downstairs neighbor, Billy Taylor's a musician. So if he can do it, why can't I? And my father didn't have an answer for that. So, but I didn't get, I wasn't getting that, okay, let's see if you can do it. So everything I've done has been an experiment, and I've always thought about what the outcome could be and always thought about a positive outcome, because without the encouragement as I had from that teacher who said, you'll make a good surgeon, I didn't have the backup. I didn't have anyone saying, you're going to be a great musician. And if you choose early music, that's fantastic. I was always told you're not going to really be a professional because you've never played cello. And that's what people said back then when I started out. Mm-hmm. And I, again said, I'm just going to have to show them. You can't say that to me.
Yeah.
So that was the premise for saying I take a risk. And I take a risk because I'm convinced that if I work really, really hard, I can overcome all of those challenges.
Yeah. When we spoke last time, over a year ago, just before the pandemic descended, and part of our conversation was about the challenge of being a person of color in the world of classical music, specifically early music. And since then, you have become really heavily involved in some task forces and committees. What is the state of diversity and inclusion, particularly anything you might have observed since we last spoke in December 2019? Is the conversation continuing in a meaningful way?
Well, the conversation in 2019 was somewhat different than the conversations that followed in 2020. Mm-hmm. I think we were much more hopeful in 2019 that we had identified the fact that there was a problem. There's always been in classical music a problem, but there are initiatives that were put into place to resolve that. And we use as a model the Sphinx Organization, which has been in existence since 1996. And the success stories that we hear coming out of that organization's advocacy programs. So it was something that I thought was right for EMA, and so did other people. You called me, other people of other organizations, early music organizations called me, and Karen Brooks from the ED of Early Music America called me. And why is that? Well, because I actually have to say I was one of the first people of color to become a professional, and the only person of color to become a professional early on on the Viola da Gamba. Mm-hmm. So I've been on the boards of the Viola da Gamba Society and EMA before, in the 90s, when we never spoke about this. It was just, mm-hmm. I felt accepted for who I was because I felt I had the qualifications. Mm-hmm. But now we're realizing that nothing has changed since 1996. Mm-hmm. But then things turned the corner in 2020, and we found ourselves not prepared for the connection with the arts and what was going on politically. Mm-hmm. And at this point, we are at a crossroads. We have heard the voices of the underrepresented. Now, I have to say that we're starting, and I'm not saying that I wasn't expecting it, but now we are hearing what happens when the majority is made to see where the faults lie, and the faults lie, according to all of us, with ignoring the fact that there is a problem. We use the term white fragility, and that's, I don't want to overuse it, but that's what it is. Now we are hearing from people in the majority who are saying, now you're making me feel as if my color makes a difference. You're making me feel as if I don't understand what it is to be ethical when it comes to accepting everyone. Mm-hmm. You're throwing Black Lives Matter into my face. Well, my life matters too. And I say that because there has been a recent letter that appeared in the New York Post by a parent at the school where I taught and where my daughter spent 13 years, calling out the school for its efforts in equity and diversity. Mm-hmm. And I'm shocked by it because the school has always been known historically as being in the forefront of equitable admissions and support for the underrepresented. Hmm. So this is where we are now. We are now seeing the response by the majority, which is not helping us move forward. It's becoming divisive. We have the Black on one side, making sure that everyone knows how we've been treated throughout history. And we have the whites on the other side saying, why are you making me feel so terrible?
This issue, and we have talked about this a little bit. I'm fortunate to be on that task force and to learn from you and the other members of it. But, you know, this is not a one and done issue. You know, there was this big rush to make public statements and, you know, pronouncements about attitude. But I think action is important and necessary. And, you know, that it's all well and good to talk the talk, but you have to walk the walk. And this is a long term process. This is an ongoing forever process. Are there places you're seeing any kind of substantive follow through, or are we not there yet?
I don't think we're there yet based on the turn of events now. It's not just this one particular incident. I can point to, there are several incidents. Mm-hmm. I think that what we're doing is we're making those statements and they're not being taken seriously. Mm-hmm. And we are being, and I say we meaning organizations, are feeling bullied, that they must have a statement that pertains to this particular issue on this particular day, and not seeing what's going to happen and what the response is going to be and how to move forward on that. And part of that is we don't talk to each other. One of the great things that we've done with EMA is once a month, one of our task force members holds a Zoom, I don't want to say meeting, but a Zoom hour where people can come and talk about these issues in a transparent way. Karen believes that it's the it's a very therapeutic way for directors and those who are in leadership to make sure that the language that they're using and the way they're approaching this is acceptable. I see it. I sit in on these conversations. I don't necessarily remark unless someone asks me to, but I see this as a way of testing the waters. Try it out on me. Also ask the questions of me. I think that if we could all get together and have that transparency without feeling threatened, then that is the beginning of making headway with this, with these issues. And I am hoping that we can get to that point. I know we have to go through this latest turn of events, and that's going to take its toll on us, but we're going to come out of it and be better able to decide how to move forward together. And that's the most important part of this initiative.
Well, I've been speaking on Zoom with Patricia Ann Neely, a New York-based professional musician and veteran member of top early music ensembles and a leading voice in trying to promote diversity and inclusion in the world of early music. Pat, thank you so much.
Thank you.